Hello, welcome to Bagel Tech Photo, the weekly photo show from the Bagel Tech Network, which is somewhat slimmed down this week because Alex is working again. No commitment, that bloke. And Kyle's got the flu. So, in fact, the flu is something that's a feature this week of the Bagel Tech Network because people have been dropping like flies today. So whether there's going to be a Mac show at 1 o'clock, I still don't know. It could be that bad. I'm joined by a bloke who's fantastically got out of bed this morning in Toronto. Chris Dick, how you doing, mate?
Hello there. I'm doing better than everyone else, it seems.
Yeah, mate, you're healthy, so keep it that way.
Let's hope so. I should have some milk then with my morning coffee to make myself feel that much more better.
Absolutely. The week in photo news has been pretty thin, it has to say. There's not a lot happened.
No, I couldn't agree more. In fact, I was looking through some of the photo news and the release of the Portra 160 film caught my eye. I was like, ooh, wow, wait a minute, I didn't even shoot on film. That's how slow it is.
No, exactly. There's a nice little bit from the unofficial Apple weblog. They've said that there's a guy's come out here, Steve Sand, and said that he thinks that the MacBook Air is the professional photographer's best friend. And it was actually a reference of a blog to Derek Story at Macworld as well. He said the same kind of thing. And I don't know what your thoughts are on that, because I know Amber's got a MacBook Air, so you're probably very experienced with the form factor as such. But I've got to say, I'm struggling to see how that is going to be the professional photographer's best friend.
Me too. I was a little late this morning, and for those tuning in visually, you can see this is the state of my MacBook Air right now. Completely black, won't turn on, won't turn off. I had to go get an old MacBook Pro, which works wonderfully. But
what's happened?
It's dead. It's fully charged. I charged it overnight. It was working,
dear God.
You know, 5 hours ago. We've actually kind of had nothing but problems with the old Air, and this is the new Air. So I can't even. It's got one USB port. I mean, it seems to me like the photographer's worst friend. I'm sure they're touting this light and a nice large screen, but it just wouldn't work for me. One USB port, that's just not the way things operate these days, this day and age.
No, exactly. It's just not a friendly computer in terms of size as well. I mean, you look at the hard drive options in it. You know, if you get a spinning drive in it, the maximum you can go to is 320. And you look at commercially available replacement drives, you're not carrying a lot of photos around there. Now, are they just talking here basically about the fact that it's powerful enough to run Aperture, iPhoto, Photoshop CS5, Lightroom 3, that kind of stuff, and it gives you a dumping ground for some of your photos instantly, but you really aren't going to be carrying an awful lot more around on that computer, certainly if you've got the SSD at 64 gig.
Yeah, I think they're just saying it looks cool. Maybe that's where they're going with it. That you'd look pretty cool if you whipped out your Air and you were doing some processing. But yeah, functionally, I'm not entirely sure that it's the greatest thing. I wouldn't want it. I want something where I could run more than one application. Ideally, I'd like something that would turn on. Kind of sit here hitting the button, and it's just not working for me. I'm not entirely sure what's going on here. This isn't the first time either. A couple days ago, same thing. I had to do a hard restart. And that's the other thing I don't like about it. And same with the new MacBooks. As you know, every once in a while, or if something's happening, if it's not working, and you've been diligent enough to save your work as you go along, 1, 2, 3, save, 1, 2, 3, save. Sometimes it's with the older MacBooks, which I can't lift up because I'm using, but it's really nice to be able to just pop out that battery and kill it and then restart it.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point because one of the things that we've had a question on the Mac show is a guy wrote in and said my MacBook battery has died in my 17-inch MacBook Pro. Can I get another one? And yes, of course you can buy one. They're £100 over here, so they're not cheap. But the beauty was that when you've gone through your kind of cycles limit on your lithium-ion battery, you know you're going to get about 300 cycles out of it as a lifespan. Then, you know, you had something you could do yourself. Now Apple are saying, okay, well, we're not going to charge you anything to replace it. But if you're actually sat there with your device and you're thinking, well, I've got a spare battery, I could swap it out myself. That's gone. You know, sitting in the field with a second battery charged up is a thing of the past as well. And the MacBook Air at 5 hours for a pro photographer, probably just not enough.
I couldn't agree more. The ability to have spares kicking around when you're in the field is partly one of the reasons why I always go out and buy the vertical hand grip for my cameras that has the AA option. Because if you're somewhere, I don't know, interesting, let's say, there's a very, very, very good chance that you may not be able to find electricity that night to power your gear for your job the next morning. But I'm pretty sure anywhere in the world you go, you can find AA batteries to get you through something quickly. So yeah. I couldn't agree more. Rechargeable batteries are kind of scary. And not even be able to have a secondary to swap out in an important situation probably, to me, doesn't make it a professional's tool.
Yeah, no, it's not a good thing at all. I don't grab it. I really don't grab it, and that's the end of it, really. Right. The other stuff. Life had a photographic history of computing. That was quite interesting. There was an iPad application that's come out with it. That you can get free of charge from the App Store. A brief history of computing. And it goes through a whole pile of stuff. I downloaded and had a little play with it. Have you had a chance to have a go with it? Or
No, I haven't. But it definitely sounds interesting. Can I confess something? I try to jailbreak everything. And I couldn't jailbreak my iPad. I had done it. I tried to do it. And I thought I did it successfully. And it turns out I jailbroke it for, I didn't necessarily update it to the OS that I needed to. So I was like, oh, geez. So I reverted it back. I restored it, updated the right OS, and then it wouldn't let me jailbreak it. So my iPad is now sort of a brick lately. I will fix this problem. Do not worry. Ooh. But I haven't had a chance to actually, and I love my iPad. It's one of the few things that I really do. Like gadget wise, I kind of shove with me everywhere I go because it has all my news sources on it. Well, it used to have all my news sources. Yeah. Now they're all gone.
No, I mean, Life magazine's always been one of those stalwarts, you know, kind of like Time magazine as well, of having the iconic image of the era. And there's stuff on here that goes back to things like guidance computers from the Apollo space program, the first iPod. You know, these are really iconic images that people have grabbed over the years, and it looks like a really nice resource. It's a coffee table type thing, really, more than anything that anyone who's a photographer would be interested in. But it was really nice, and it's free, so you can't really complain at free stuff, can you?
No, not at all. And I can't believe how much Life is as an organization sort of adapting. I mean, they were the ones to pioneer the long form photo essay, and then we kind of lost that in the 80s, and they went under, and now it seems they're back again, mostly from the archive, but putting out products and doing sort of comprehensive looks at things. It's great.
Absolutely.
Do you use your iPad as a portfolio?
No, I tend to. I mean, I'll carry it around with a selection of images on it that I can show to customers. I've used the camera kit a lot more than anything else because, you know, I'll take stuff off the computer and I'll dump them on there and then just pass them over so that they can just see kind of the rushes, if you like, of stuff that I've shot during the day. I don't put anything on there that's particularly, like, you know, touched images or stuff. I like the integration with the iPhoto library as well, so you can dump out all your iPhoto stuff and just have a almost like a Dropbox with iPhoto, so you drag anything in that you want from the day and then it'll instant sync with your iPad to show around. I've got to say the iPad for me is more sitting around at home than it is using it at work. I've got a little fold-out desktop keyboard and stuff that I can use with it. And I use that in meetings periodically, but I haven't used it an awful lot for what I thought I'd use it for. I mean, I'd be interested to hear what you say, but all the things I thought I could do with it, I've just either never got round to doing, or they were a great idea, but actually in practice and actuality, they were a complete waste of time. What do you use yours for?
Well, it's definitely turned into my newspaper of choice. Yeah, so exactly. I actually use it to bring it. I've gone back and started and subscribed to magazines and newspapers that I had previously not subscribed or just had let lapse over the years. So my Foreign Affairs and Financial Post, Wall Street Journal, all these things, I've, you know, it's just a lot easier to allow past issues to collect up digitally than to actually physically have them collect up. So, and I like the archives and that. So it's actually done quite a bit to help, at least from my perspective and my pocketbook, save the dying print industry for news. And that's pretty much all these for. I have some games on there for my kid. But what I'm looking at, but the reason I ask is because I actually am looking into using it as a portfolio, because it can handle both photos and videos well, and you can just slide it into your briefcase or, you know, your photo backpack, whatever. And the battery life's pretty good, but if you charge it before a meeting, obviously you're never gonna have any problems. And people can pass it around, you can export it, export the video to another monitor. So I've been starting to think maybe, so I've been looking at different apps and trying to figure out, once I get my iPad back, what I might put on there, and maybe different ways of using it as a portfolio. That's why I was curious. So if anyone else listening uses it, post the comments, whatever. Just if there's any tips or that, or if anyone's had any successes, or if anyone's had major failures, I'd still bring my book along. I'm looking at it over there. It's just a brick now. It's actually holding on, it's holding down something. But I would still bring my regular book just in case, because I'm a redundant kind of guy. So I don't like when things break. Obviously, if I can go back to my air again.
You're feeling kind of low now, aren't you? Because you really want your iPad back, even though you didn't use it, just because you've lost your air. When your air's back, that's you'll be using the iPad will be back propping the books up again, and that'll be the end of it. And you'll be saying to the air, all the time I was using the iPad, I was thinking of you.
Don't be jealous. Please come back to life.
Last story is the Samsung launched 5 iFunction NS series lenses. I don't know anything at all about interchangeable Samsung lenses and the cameras that they're on, because I've never really got into the Samsung camera thing at all, even with, you know, like the point and shoots and stuff. Have you got any experience with Samsung in terms of practical application and use and so on?
No, but I definitely think it's interesting that we're seeing I don't know what you term the companies, I guess non-photo companies, really making a push and trying to put a quality product in that. It's, I wonder where things are going to be heading down the road, you know?
These are a 16 mil compact lens at f2.4. You've got an 85 mil prime lens at 1.4 on the f-stop, which is,
yeah.
I mean, generally, you know, you get your low f-stop lenses, and they cost you an absolute bloody fortune. So the fact that these have actually got anything at all is quite interesting, and the fact that they're coming out with very versatile, you know, very artistic lenses at that kind of price, and they've got an 18-200 as well, which, I mean, they're notoriously bad for over focus, but I mean, it depends what these things. I mean, the story on Engadget says, you know, they launch 5 more new NX series lenses. We long for broader compatibility, and therein comes back to exactly the same crux of problem that always jinxes the photography world is the bayonet fittings.
Yes. Everything is. My life is adapters, especially when you get into shooting video and doing transferring all these video cameras that now take DSLR lenses and this and the other thing. And it's just, you end up with rings and rings and rings of adapters, and it looks like step rings or something. I'm amazed. I feel like I'm an old photographer with a bunch of things for my bellows and stuff. Like, it's just sort of, it's unbelievable. And actually, I'm just reading here that the NX series lenses, there's a 700 millimeter out as well.
Right.
I guess sports photography. I'm not entirely sure. Like, that's, they're really pushing hard.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to question how good that's going to be, though. I mean, I mean, you look at the size and weight of the 700 mil lenses for Canon, and you know, that are decent sports lenses, and they're f4 and that kind of, you know, but they're huge. I just don't see, I can't see a consumer need for a 700 mil lens unless it's just for bird spotting or something, perhaps. But
oh yeah, there you go.
You can keep. Yeah, bird
you can
spotting.
Position it kind of like that. It's like a nature thing. I mean. With the high ISOs that they have now, maybe that might work. I never thought of that.
You can keep that, though. I'm not going to be bothered. I take pictures of birds once in a while, but I'm not obsessed.
Right. I wouldn't. Margaret Atwood, the author, We recently interviewed her for another show. She has so many bird apps on her iPhone and goes around, and it's amazing how bird spotting can just totally consume your life. I mean, it's great. I mean, I love them and they're wonderful indicators for things, I suppose. But if you're not in the zone, it's very cult-like. And the fact that they have so many different products for it and that. But yeah, I never thought of a 700 on a little point and shoot kind of thing for those instances when you find yourself in front of the red-breasted robin of the year. You gotta
Exactly.
snap it.
No. I mean, that's me though all over. I mean, I've taken pictures of the moon handheld with a 200mm sports lens with two times converters added onto it, and I've actually got a decent shot
Oh, must have been a bright moon.
at
That's
night.
yeah.
Look, I did okay there. I'm quite pleased with that. The bigger part of today's show, based on the fact that there was no bloody news whatsoever, is definitely going to be the questions. And Chris has only got to see the first question this morning. And
Really?
based on the question that we're going to get from this guy, no more questions, please. Because
Yeah, this is quite the benchmark for
it's a toughie. Right, we'll start off with the first part of the question because that's the easy bit. Hey guys, loving the show. Ewan mentioned some time ago that if he was shooting in a studio, his golden rule was one source of light. I've been learning about studio lighting on an adult education course that I signed up to at a school near me, and this hasn't been mentioned so far. In fact, we're using lots of lights in the practical work. Now, he's got a second part to the question we'll come to afterwards.
Yeah.
So, the first question is, did I say that the golden rule was one source of light? Well, my golden rule is one source of light for the subject. So if you're taking pictures of people, for example, the thing is that people are round, they're not flat. So the more light sources you add, the flatter you make them. So I will always try and have one single source of light for the person. And if I need areas that need lifting or hollowing, then I'll use reflectors or backboards to lighten or soften it. And that tends to be just about it, really. Background and that kind of stuff, then I'll use lots and lots of lights, and I might even occasionally just use, you know, like a snoot and highlight a piece of hair or a hat or something like that separately.
Yeah, a nice rim light can go a long way.
But generally speaking, you know, my start point is I'm only going to use one source of light for anything that's three dimensional, because otherwise it just doesn't look three dimensional. Have you got any thoughts on that, Chris? Because I mean, that's kind of my rule, but I'm sure it's not everyone's.
No, I couldn't agree more. Actually, simpler the better. And I don't necessarily subscribe to the Joe McNally school of photography where you rent an extra car so you can carry your 72-inch octagonal, you know, which looks great. Don't get me wrong. I'd love to have a giant Ellen Chrome softbox, but I'm more of a quick and dirty kind of guy. So you have your main, and then your, you know, but a rim light. I love either bouncing or putting, like you said, something with a nice snoot right behind someone and popping that up a stop or two more just to give a little definition to the edge and separate them out from the background. And then whatever else is in the background that's important. It's I follow the same rule as if you're shooting natural light. You know, you expose for your greatest highlight. Make sure the what you think is the most important part of the photograph is exposed for, and then let the rest fall into shadow. And then I kind of extend that into filling it with artificial light. And it's a lot easier now with the digital backs, or, you know, there's a whole trend occurring where, because of the high ISOs of cameras, photographers are using hot lights to light their subjects now, just like you would a video shoot. So there's no actual strobe, which brings the overall cost down. And so that's interesting. You can get real-time results, what you see with your eyes, more or less what you get.
The rule there in nature is nature's only got one source of light, so
yeah,
and everything
kind
of looks pretty good, so go from that point. Second part of the question.
Let's read this very carefully.
I've also noticed that if I dial down my f-stop setting, I get a shallower depth of field, which I would have figured, but I get the depth of field of what would normally be about a 2.8 lens in natural light at about f8 under studio lights, and I can't figure out why. Do you know? You said you had a student, Chris, who's got a similar question.
Yeah, sort of. This kind of reverse phenomenon. They are telling me that they're reading. So what she claims is that the ISO, same kind of thing, though. If she drops it, she gets more light coming in. And I don't understand. So the only thing I could think of is because she's kind of using a little bit older camera, is that it's maybe it's just a display because I don't know what kind of camera he's using. So if he's using sort of like a, I don't know, like a Pentax K1 or Nikon FM2, there's clearly no, you know exactly where your f-stop is. I mean, there's no question about it. It's mechanical. You hear a click. But maybe with the newer cameras, you know, where there's actually no, where it's all the computer in it, maybe the display is incorrect. And so, but I'm not entirely sure that would work necessarily for this case. But in her case, maybe when she does drop it down to 100, the computer puts it to 1,000 and vice versa. It's the display that's incorrect because another student has all these pink photos, which means the sensor is dying. So
Right.
with this, though, I mean, the look, he's talking about the look. So you get certain depth of field at 2A natural light and then F8 under studio lights. I mean,
I think what he's saying here is that what he would do outside at f2.8 in a studio distance kind of setting. So don't forget that your depth of field is based on your distance from your subject. So, you know, f2.8 at 100 yards is going to be pointless in effect. You might as well shoot an f4 for all it matters. Or worse. So what he's saying is that if he takes a picture, I think outside at a normal distance at 2.8, he gets that very stark depth of field effect where the subject's very focused and everything else is completely blurred. But he's saying that in a studio, he gets f8, he gets the same effect on the output image.
All I can think of is that when he hooks up the strobes, it's the camera is defaulting to I suppose like an aperture priority, and it's, you know what I mean, like it's something like that. Because physically, like light is light, you could your camera can only focus on a single plane, and that's it. So wherever you set it, that's on focus. And then of course, like we said, the f-stop determines the illusion of focus around the single plane of focus. I mean, that's physics, that can't change. And daylight versus studio lights, I'm assuming he's using strobes, so they're packing a wall up. And if his camera sort of wants it, you know, if he's not shooting TTL, maybe it's defaults to the F8 and be there kind of thing when you put in the remote. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, is that ever,
Well, the
you
only
know?
thing that I came across was this idea of the strobe, because I mean, the thing that you've got with studio lights is they are brutal to a certain degree, aren't they? I mean, you're talking about very, very high outputs of light for very short periods of time. And generally speaking, if you get out, you've got a sync range on your camera, so kind of from 1/60th of a second up to 200, 2 2 250th,
250.
something like that, yeah. Then the camera will sync with the flashes. However, you've got to watch out for the fact that when you get past that, then you get all kinds of things happen that you can't predict. And
Right.
sometimes you get great effects, but other times it just looks horrific.
Or you just see your shutter,
Yeah,
right? You have
exactly.
a little half
Partway
black
through.
thing. You're like, wait a minute, is that my actual sh did I just photograph my shutter?
So all I can think is that you've probably, depending on what your ISO is, you tend to use a low ISO in studio because you can control the light using the lights themselves. So all I'm thinking is with the low ISO, when you just suddenly open up the f-stop setting, there must be like maybe the depth of field is affected due to the intensity of the light, and because the strobe is such an intense light, it's perhaps having an influence on the depth of field naturally. Now, as you say, Chris, you don't know whether this is just something in the readout that's coming off the back of the camera, but if this is on the final image that he's printing out, then I can't put it down to anything else other than the light seems to be affecting the depth of field, but that goes kind of a little bit against the physics of it.
Yeah, because you'd still need to. That's what I mean. I think you're. I mean, that's what I think. You're on like that kind of. The light is so powerful, it's just tripping in, auto expo or you know aperture priority or something. I mean,
It's just
there
so
just has to be
intense.
something in the settings that we are competing. You know, it's so strange. Like again, it's just entirely camera dependent because if you're on a mechanical camera, there's you know where you stand. But these digital cameras, you never know where you stand. It's the computer that decides. And you know, you can look at the XIF data, XDEV later, and see where you're at.
Yeah, no, that'd be interesting as well.
Yeah, but I mean, as far as like kind of looking at that window and turning on a little light, you know, you are held hostage to what the computer says is happening. And then you know, you can't really trust the back of the thing either. I mean,
No. No, that's why
histograms are handy. Exactly. You know, you just sort of really quickly have a reference and see where your shadows and highlights are, and then that's pretty much it for the back screen. That's why I kind of think it's funny with camera manufacturers. I mean, it's nice to have a larger LCD at the back, but they tout, oh, this is bigger, and this does make life easier, but it's not the end-all and be-all. Like, you know, as long as I have that little mini zoom button to see if that guy's in focus, and I got a histogram to see if I'm generally in the right area, we're pretty much off to the races.
I'm just sitting here thinking, if we just spent the last 10 minutes saying we don't know.
Yeah, I know. In wonderful creative ways that we don't know.
Yeah, we kind of realize why we don't know. Yeah, that's different.
But it is very an interesting challenge. I hope somebody out there has something.
Well, there's an interesting point. We'll ask Alex, because Alex is very into his studio photography because of what he does. So he might have an answer to that one. But if you do know the answer to that one, absolutely, and you're sure that you know, don't write in because you think, then send us an email, bageltechphoto@gmail.com, and we'll read it out next week. But I think all I can keep coming back is this strength of the light thing. That's kind of it. Thank you, John in Pennsylvania. Keep your emails to yourself from now on.
Or send in the pictures afterwards. It'd definitely be a great case study to see what, you know, what are you shooting? How do you know for sure that's happening? Do a wonderful little flicker set on all the different things that you're doing.
Yeah, no. I did have a colleague once years ago who said, I don't tend to like to drop below sort of F11 or F8 because the depth of field gives me a problem. I've got that in the back of my head, but I don't know if that's true or whether I've made that up because I've got the question. So we'll see.
Drop below. So he just likes everything. So he just errs inside of caution with his focus. Yeah. And just like, it's all going to be there.
No, I mean, I'd rather get, you know, shortened depth of field in some of the studio portraits and stuff. That'd be really cool.
Yeah.
Question two. Hi, fellas. I recently bought a lens from eBay which showed the lens as in perfect shape, and it is, but it had a UV filter on it when it arrived, and I can't get it off. Not sure if it's cross-threaded or perhaps rusted on, but I don't see any sign of rust. Do you have any suggestions as to how to get it off? I'm scared to put it in anything to grip it. I'm guessing something like a workshop vise or something, in case I break the lens. I can always get another UV filter, though, right? Well, very sensible, Doug. Doug Joyner in Jacksonville. Any ideas, mate?
Yeah, a couple things. So you don't want to use any oils. I've actually had this happen to me. And you don't want to use any oil at all because that can get in there and mess things up. But you can use like a rubber mat. Mm-hmm. Rubber does a good job of allowing you to apply pressure. So like a rubber glove or something you'd use for dishwashing. And it does a good job of sort of allowing you to apply pressure evenly around the edges of it, because you don't want to pure brute force, if it's, especially with your hands, if it's not even, it is cross-threaded or it's been slightly impacted. That's usually what ends up happening with my filters, is that the lens is dropped a little bit, not enough to break anything, but it's sort of impacted itself in there. So it's a little uneven.
Yeah.
Because you should never put those on too tight, you know, as soon as they sit down, then they're ready to go. Mm-hmm. But a rubber glove will do a pretty good job of sort of correcting where your hand will naturally put too much pressure on one side, not the other, and you have no idea what side it is. So sort of just in your palm, and then you turn it and the rubber should grip, and then you just need some muscles. Or the household appliance trick. So, you know, if you have a mechanical camera, not digital, but if it goes in the water, you kind of dry it out in like an oven at low heat, the key is that you don't want any humidity. I haven't done, but I have heard, because I've actually used the rubber glove and it works fine. But if that doesn't work, the freezer. So you put it in a Ziploc baggie again, so you have moisture problems in that, and then you put it in your freezer for like an hour. And as we know, physics, things should shrink, because often it gets caught. So if it's not stuck because of an impact, then it could just be sort of junk stuck inside little mini rock, whatever it is. And so the cool should shrink everything and allow just enough, allow it to loosen up just enough that it might give you the edge. And then after that, I wouldn't know what to do. Those two things didn't work.
No, I was thinking something like, you know, the kind of structure of a fan belt, you know, that kind of thing where you can wrap it around the outside and like jar openers.
Or the way, yeah, the things that open, that twist off oil cans.
They're
from
pretty
your
good.
Car.
I like the rubber glove idea, though. I think that's pretty cool because that gives you, you can certainly feel it. It's tactile. You're not going to put too much pressure on it. You've still got that sensibility of touch. But yeah, I mean, like you say, though, as well, the other thing that you could do if you really are absolutely up against it is try and think about cutting the UV lens out very carefully. If you're not going to damage it, then, or you're not bothered about damage it, try and get some kind of, drill a hole in it, make sure you don't go through to the lens, obviously, but then start to think about the fact you've got a point there where you can pull something on or push something in to force the turn. I mean, if you're saying that the, I mean, I'm presuming that the UV filter's coming off because it's damaged, and you don't want it on there. If that's the case and it's damaged already, then, you know, if the lens is useless with it on, it's going to be equally useless with it off, even if you break it. So you might be a Hobson's choice, effectively, you know.
So how do you drill in? How do you do that?
If you get a drill, and put it on a very, very fine drill, as low as you can, drill a very, very small pilot hole with a metal drill in the glass. Be very careful not to push too hard and keep plenty of moisture around the top, or use something like an oil or a jelly. I've used, this was a tip I got from a guy years ago. They use, if you, you know, like when you look at animated puppet stuff that's stop motion, they use what a thing over here called KY jelly, which is a lubricant jelly.
Yeah.
But it's got like a watery texture to it, so they can use it and make fake water out of it. And
saying, it's not oil based. Okay.
So he said, if you want to use that, he said you could make almost like a cutting compound out of that, and it'll help you cut holes in glass as well. And then you can also use a masonry drill, and masonry drills are really, really good at opening out glass, and just open a small hole, and that'll just give you something to grab onto, or it'll allow you to lever the glass out perhaps from the ring, and then you can crush the ring to take it out of the thread afterwards.
So you drill down the center. This is, and it won't, and with the KY jelly it shouldn't shatter or go crazy, so it'll keep it intact. And then you so then what do you stick in there to get out? This is fat. You remove, you hate glass, don't you? Like from monitors of computers and from the ends of lenses. Like, I mean, well, how do you,
I don't know how you'd actually physically do it, but I mean, once you've opened up a small hole, it would give the ability to break the glass outwards so that you're not damaging the lens. And if you break the glass and take it out without damaging the lens, then you can crush the ring.
Okay.
I mean, it's last resort, because you really run the risk of completely screwing your lens up here. But if the lens is useless because you've got a stuck UV filter that's scratched in it, then at that point, you know, where else are you going to go?
And that's kind of where I'm at. Hold on, I'm just going to grab my battery power. But that's where I'm at on one of my lenses, so that's why I'm very curious of it.
Yeah, I mean, allegedly, if you take like I say, KY jelly or something like that as a lubrication, it just helps to keep the glass from shattering, and it should solve your problem. But I mean, don't try that one at all, Doug, until you're at your wit's end and you have got a completely useless lens. If you don't do it,
but if that occurs, videotape it and put it online and send us a link, because
absolutely,
that would be really interesting to watch. And I may be there if I can't get a UV off another one of my lenses.
Well, I've got an old Canon F lens that doesn't fit any cameras that I've currently got. So it's probably worth about $5 on eBay. So I might just see if I can get a UV lens. I mean, UV lens is only going to be 10. That would be an absolutely great YouTube video, wouldn't it? We'll do it.
Oh my God, yeah, because I didn't even know you could, I mean, You always kind of think that, but like they're smash it, but you'd never really seriously consider. At least I would never really seriously consider, because you're just like, well, what do I use, like a hammer? Even if I never thought of drilling it out and then breaking it, and then it would definitely make a great YouTube video for sure.
Right, I'm gonna dig out my old lens. I'm gonna do it. There you go. Promise. I don't know if it's going to be today, though. Well, it might be, actually, because I might not be doing any shows later on.
Yeah. That's true.
Last word, as always, goes to our sponsors, uk2.net. They are the people that give us all the bandwidth, and they we'd be lost without them. We consume an enormous amount of data. They are brilliant to us. They're going to start doing some competitions on some of the podcasts as well in the coming months. So please, if you're watching the podcast, then go and click on the link on our website, bageltechnews.com. There's a little UK2 logo at the bottom. That tracks through to UK2. They know that we've sent you. You're not going to get any spam. You're not going to get any, you know, people clicking back through to you. You're not going to get any malware down the pipe or anything like that, or a cookie. It's just a case of they know that you have bothered to come through our website to get to UK2, and then it keeps their sponsorship going. Because if their sponsorship goes, we go. It's as simple as that. We haven't got the money to pay for the bandwidth that we're consuming on the 10 shows that we're currently broadcasting. So please, go to the website, click on UK2, and show your support for Bagel Tech and for them for the sterling job that they do. Thank you very much, UK2.net. Chris,
yes.
Last words. Where can we get a hold of you, pal?
You can get me at Chris Dick on Twitter. I find I use that more and more now instead of just different websites or whatever. It's just sort of, there's my Twitter handle. There's a link on there and away we go.
Website's on there as well if they want to bother and look. So, yeah, it's good.
Yep.
Now, we had a question a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't want to jump it on you today, but we do the cool thingy on the Bagel Tech Big Show, which is something cool from the net, and we do the eye thingy on the Mac Show. Someone suggested, because we're always coming out with these cheap tricks, you know, like using, like you said the other week, using a napkin to dim down a flash a little bit, and I've done the same with tissue paper and that kind of thing. Have you got off the? I'll do mine first, and that gives you a second to think. But have you got a cheap thingy, something that's you don't have to spend a lot of money on for photography, but you can still, make a huge difference? Mine actually came from a tweet this week that I got from a professional photographer. I was following him on Twitter, and he tweeted out saying, "I've just had a problem with my tripod slipping and sliding all over a floor. Now I've got the excuse that I want to go and buy myself something really nice, like a Manfrotto or Giotto." Tripod. And I tweeted back to him, go down to your local Halfords and buy yourself a $5 car mat. Cut it up into tiny little squares, and it's brilliant because it's got ridges all over it. So when you apply the pressure, it squeezes the ridges out and they grip to pretty much anything. Keep it clean and it should last you quite a while. And $5 means you aren't buying a brand new tripod. So there's my cheap thingy. You don't need a lot of money for that. It's a piece of cake.
Oh, I like that. That's very good. And for us winter drivers, we should always have floor mats in the car anyway, just to help on the slippery ice.
I've got this mission. And someone wrote in the other week saying, you know, we love the cheap tips that you guys give us. You should make a feature of that. So I'm happy. I love the cheap tips. Anyone that goes out and spends a fortune on photography, you're not a photographer, is my view.
Yeah, the DIY nature of things. Okay, I got one actually that maybe will appeal to some people who are doing using their cameras for video, since they all take video now, and when they're on their tripods. And this is because this is just in the top of my head, because I actually emailed somebody yesterday to do this on one of their shots. And when you're sort of panning from left to right, especially on for photographers that aren't used to using like video heads or that, and they want a smooth ending, and you can't afford like a slider, using elastic, so you pull the handle with the elastic instead of moving it with your hand, and just let the elastic go, and then ease up the tension, and it'll naturally fall, it'll naturally slow down. So you just go left, and then right, and then as the elastic stretches, then it obviously certain amount of tension brings in, and then you just let it go and it just comes to a slow rest.
Dude, that's a brilliant one.
Yeah, so it's a nice smooth panning option, just with an elastic on your handle. And so with an elastic that comes with your paper every morning, then you can just wrap that around, shove it around your wrist for the day, and you always have smooth pans available. And that's free.
That's really cool, because you could go to Staples and get a bag of bands, and you've got a complete set of gauges for the speed of your pan there. You know, the big thick one gives you something that's really pushy, and then the little tiny thin one's really slow. That's brilliant.
Exactly, yep. And if you're working with talent or whatever, women always have hair elastics kicking around, so they're not hard to find stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Brilliant, mate. I love that one.
And I did get, so on a quasi-unrelated note, which I haven't been able to put on my iPhone, though, I did grab a detachable mobile phone camera lens, a 180 fisheye. We were talking about the ridiculously long telephoto lens for your iPhone the other day. And so I grabbed a ridiculously wide a fisheye for it. I haven't put it on my iPhone 4 yet because the Ring covers the flash. So I was waiting for Amber to get back, and I might put it on the Touch and see how it works.
Yeah.
So I'll have results next time.
Brilliant. Okay. Great. Well, we'll see you next week for Bagel Tech Photo. Thanks ever so much for coming and joining us and listening and watching the chat room. We'll see you again in a week's time.